I wonder what you did with your weekend, or are about to do with what remains of your weekend. I know some of you will be watching football later this afternoon. I will not. So. Depending upon where you are in the world, and if you're involved in a Christian community, you might be doing something very different than what you would be doing. Tomorrow, January 6th, in the Eastern and Orthodox Christian tradition, is the observance of Christmas, so that makes today Christmas Eve for our Orthodox Eastern sisters and brothers. And in France and Spain, Mexico, and many Latin American cultures, it will be the festive day of the Three Kings. It's full of special celebrations, foods, exchanges of gifts. Today, January 5th, this Sunday nearest January 6th, in many churches will be observed Epiphany. It's a word that means appearance, manifestation, revelation, to give light. And it's a period that begins on January 6th and follows that are stories about how the birth and the manifestation of Jesus in the world, his appearance at the beginning of his ministry. And the first story we hear in the season of Epiphany is the famous story from Matthew, with its central characters who are so familiar but still enigmatic. And they dwell in the Christmas pageants of our childhood and maybe even adult imaginations. They enter stage, most likely three men or children with fake beards, in some kind of regal attire, carrying ornate gift boxes with expensive, but let's face it, really odd gifts to give a baby. They stand or kneel at a tidy manger next to a serene Mary and a pious Joseph, and there are some shepherds, and a star twinkles or gleams overhead. It is a lovely creche tableau. And at the end of that tableau, the curtain closes, and these enigmatic characters are gone. It's Matthew's version of the gospel, Matthew alone, who gives us this story of the wise men who follow the star to Bethlehem. And like so many other overly familiar Bible stories, centuries of tradition have both oversimplified it and over-embellished it. But even on its own terms, without the embellishments of our traditions, the story of this visit by the Magi remains a story that sparks our imagination endlessly because it has some really intriguing details. Matthew tells us that these visitors are, quote, magi, which meant astrologers or magicians. Magi, not kings. Identified as coming from the East, which means these magi were likely priests from Persia, experts in astrology and the occult. They were people who were experienced. They were the experts in the studying and interpretation of the movements of the natural world. Think about it. They would have been considered the preeminent scientists of their day for their observations and communications. They were not kings themselves, apparently, but they were very likely attached to the royal court, so they were themselves probably wealthy by any terms in the ancient world. And it never specifies exactly how many magi there were, if you notice. Now, the story names three very expensive, highly symbolic gifts, but never says how many magi. Their gifts, gold, symbolic of the wealth of royalty, frankincense, the incense that even in Jewish tradition was used for the worship of the deity, and myrrh, an expensive resin. It was equal in its weight to gold, used for anointing, perfume, and occasionally for embalming and healing. The reference to Mary and the child being in a house, plus, if you read on in Matthew chapter 2, other tragic details that immediately follow this, indicate that the Jesus whom the Magi met was almost certainly not newborn, but maybe even a 2-year-old toddler by the time the Magi arrived. A very interesting story, often quite different than our imaginations. These enigmatic and unnamed but famous pagan priest scientists, the Magi, interpreted the signs that they saw in the heavens, and they knew some auspicious event was underway, something of great magnitude, and it motivated them to undertake a dangerous and long travel to Jerusalem, a journey of many months, if not nearly 2 years, to pay homage to what they knew was a new royal birth. They arrive in Jerusalem, the center of Jewish life, cultural and religious life, and these wealthy, colorful characters, leading practitioners of a foreign religion, worshipped an altogether different god, were very noticeable in Jerusalem. They couldn't have been more unlike the Jewish citizens of Jerusalem in their cultural and religious worldview. But unhindered, they inquired and went directly to the royal court. They were comfortable with courtly life, certainly. And they inquired about the birth of the new king. Surely the seated king would know something of this auspicious event, which Herod does not. They also apparently assume that it would be welcomed and celebrated news, which it most definitely was not. Herod was frightened, and it says all of Jerusalem was frightened at this news. The location of the birth was confirmed by the Jewish equivalent of the Magi, the scribes and priests, and they continue their journey to Bethlehem, following the star. They show homage, they open their extravagant gifts to what must have been a shocked family. Can you imagine them knocking on your door? Then the Magi, warned in a dream, wisely do not return to Herod, but return by a different route. They leave the scent of frankincense and myrrh in their wake, and this magical, multicultural, interfaith encounter ends. That's the last the Bible ever tells us of the Magi, and our imaginations are left to fill in the blanks. As a footnote, just after this, Matthew tells us of how Joseph and Mary and Jesus flee to Egypt to escape Herod's bloody attempt to exterminate the political competition. And through this short story of the Magi, which we rarely hear in all of its interesting nuance, the author of Matthew wants us to notice that there is a tension, a spiritual tension, from the very beginning of Jesus' life. This arrival of God incarnate was remarkable, miraculous, good news, and not just for the chosen people, but it was to be celebrated and embraced by the whole world, represented strikingly by these prominent Magi. But the tension is, it was not ever going to be easy news. The challenge to the established order would be met with resistance, and sometimes even violently, foreshadowed in this little story of the Magi. So the story of the wise men following the star is not so simple or childlike after all. Because it is so intriguing, and the Magi so colorful and still elusive, I want more details out of this story. I want to make up my own play of the Magi showing up. There are so few details and so many blanks. But when I reviewed this story again, I get a yearly opportunity to review and preach on this story, which is one of my favorites. There was a detail that Matthew included in this short story, a rather mundane detail, in fact, that struck me this time around. And it's the detail that states, upon kneeling and paying homage, the Magi, quote, opened their treasure chests to reveal the gifts inside. The Magi opened their treasure chests to reveal the gifts inside. This is a rather mundane detail that I never noticed before, and it struck me this time. We don't get any glimpse of how the journey affected the Magi, nor do we ever know what happened to them upon their return home. But at a moment's glance, at a moment of reflection, we know that someone does not undertake such a pilgrimage, such an arduous journey, and have a face-to-face encounter with the incarnation of God. One does not take that journey, have that encounter, and remain unmoved or unchanged. Imagine their preparation in Persia, getting ready for the trip, not only making sure all the logistics of the caravan and their retinue of servants that certainly came along, how to plan and manage all of that, but selecting and acquiring these gifts. They would have had access to the highest quality because of their status and position. And then they locked them tightly away in treasure chests, safe, secure, guarded, impenetrable for months, if not years. These chests of treasure, jostled on the backs of camels or donkeys or horses or on the backs of servants, waiting to be opened. Upon their arrival and encounter with this holy child, they worship and with joy they open these chests. The locks fall away, the lids creak open, a gleam of gold lights the room, and the scent of heavy spice and fragrance rush to fill the room after being contained for so long. They opened their treasure chests. That detail communicates to me that their encounter was not complete. The gift was not given until the chest that had been protected and sealed was opened wide to reveal its treasure. This is Epiphany. It's a word that means appearance, manifestation. And we hear stories of how this encounter, this appearance, this manifestation of Jesus Christ to the world is recognized. And in those stories, we see somehow a core characteristic of Jesus and God's work in Jesus illuminated, an aha moment, as it were, where we're hoped that we'll understand what Jesus is about. But ahas are more than moments of intellectual insight, more than even a manifestation of God. The epiphanies are invitations to spiritual transformation. They invite us to open our deepest treasure in the presence of the divine. When I was thinking about this idea of treasure, a couple of weeks ago, I went and saw the second installment of the Hobbit trilogy. Has anyone seen that yet? Okay. Oh my goodness, hardly any of you, which is fine. I'm not commending it to you necessarily if you're not. I'm just saying, you know. So I'm just shocked. How many of you are going to watch the Super Bowl, though? That's wrong. That's wrong. I'm just saying this. I'm getting judgy all of a sudden. One of the best scenes, one of the best moments in the Hobbit movie, is where hopefully you know a little bit of the story, where Bilbo Baggins goes into the mine, goes into actually the underground city formerly occupied by the dwarves, where the dragon Smaug has overtaken and basically guarded the treasure of the dwarves. It's a fantastic, beautiful scene. I only saw it in 2D, 3D might be more exciting. It's a spectacular dragon. Oh my gosh, great dragon effects. Sorry, I'm geeking out just a little bit. Anyhow. But what is so amazing about it is how this fearsome dragon is guarding this treasure against this tiny little hobbit. Is not willing to relinquish even a coin of these mountains upon mountains of treasure. And it led me to wonder about what treasures are hidden within each of us. Do we not all have great things that we treasure inside of us? They may be possessions in our lives, but if we pause for a moment, I think those things that we treasure most are not our possessions. I hope it's clear I'm not talking about a monetary treasure at this point, but those things that we hold most dear. There is a saying of Jesus, if you'll recall, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Where's your treasure? What's your hidden treasure? It may be something that we love so dearly and desperately, or something so intimately personal that it is the engine that drives our life. For some of us, that treasure might be something painful, but that we grasp and hide and lock away in that treasure chest. And many of us have treasures that are guarded by dragons, no less fearsome than the dragon Smaug, that are not going to relinquish that treasure under any circumstances, are going to attack and kill any that come close. We fear the loss of the treasure. Somehow it will be taken or stolen. But that is not how God works. That is not God's approach, invitation to our treasure. Not to take or to steal. It seems that in that authentic encounter with the living God, our treasure chests will open and the gift will simply come out. That in that encounter, our treasure chest will open and the gift within will come out. There are songs and carols about the Magi, and they may not get the details right, but they get the spiritual truth correct. From the little drummer boy, the song that says, "I have no gift to bring other than the playing of my drum." To my favorite Christmas carol, "In the Bleak Midwinter," it ends with the phrase, "What I have, I give thee my heart." It is not gold or frankincense or myrrh, but the treasures of our hearts that are the gifts that are unlocked and given. We can be modern magi. We are all on our way seeking to meet or welcome something new or unknown or even different in the divine. We might journey with clear and careful purposefulness. We might bear extravagant gifts within. But like the Magi, who journeyed for months to Bethlehem, following a star and having
that encounter. Like the Magi, the encounter is not complete until our chest opens and it gives its treasure.